Mr. Condren, Reel 1. Where were you born?
I was born in Bathgate, West Lothian, Scotland.
Which year was that?
1928, October 1928.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was an engineer with the post office. Ex-army man, he had been in the First World War, he was also in the Second World War. Came back from Dunkirk, spent most of the Second World War in London working on telephones during the bombing, telephone lines.
And what was your education?
I just went to ordinary school. I left school when I was 14. I had always wanted to go into the Merchant Navy as a radio officer. And I left school at 14. I worked for about a year, saved up some money, and then I went to Wireless College in Edinburgh, and I studied there, I suppose, about a year and a half, 2 years. And at that point, that was 1945, the war just ended then, which meant that there was a bit of a glut of radio officers on the market. Because obviously at the end of the war they laid off ships, and there were too many men for too few ships, and they then introduced some ruling whereby you could only get on board ship through the pool. They had a thing called the pool. You could only get a ship if you'd had 6 months sea service, and this of course left people like myself a little bit out in the cold. It was a kind of catch-22 situation, whereby you could get a ship if you'd had 6 months sea service, and if you had, well, it was set up obviously to protect people who had been in the war, you know, and come out and suddenly found themselves unemployed. So I went on for a few months after that, and I got a bit fed up. I was only 17. I was very eager for adventure and travel and so on, and then I decided to that I wanted to become a commando. Obviously, I'd been brought up during the war years. You know, you're constantly reading about adventure and the war, and a lot of it to me at that time was, of course, largely adventure, large element of patriotism in it, I suppose, too. Anyway, I decided I wanted to become a commando, and then when I made inquiries, unbeknown to my mother and father, I didn't tell them anything at all. I went to the Naval Recruiting Office in Edinburgh, and I had a chat with them in there, and then it was explained to me that well, the only way I could become a commander was to join the Royal Marines, because at the end of the during the war they had your commando brigades were split into two. You had Army Commandos and you had Royal Marine Commandos. At the end of the war they disbanded the Army Commandos, and all commandos from that time on until the present day were under the aegis of the Royal Marines. So I was in a little bit of a quandary. I didn't sort of know what to do. I said, oh, well, I'll join the Royal Marines. But he said, then the only catch was you had to join for 12 years. You couldn't join the Royal Marines for a short engagement. At that time, of course, there was still people were still being called up. I wasn't then of age to be called up, but I decided I wanted to be a commando. I didn't want to be called up and be put into something I didn't particularly like. So I decided to join the Marines, and for 12 years. Then, of course, I had to tell my parents, because I was only 17 and a half at the time. And they weren't very pleased about it.
Why not?
Well, because I'd studied to go into the Merchant Navy, and that was something I had always wanted to do ever since I was a child. And they thought that would probably be a more attractive prospect, I suppose, in the long run for me. But then I explained to them, well, you know, when you're young, you don't necessarily see the future as being as changing suddenly. You tend to think that the situation as it is now is likely to continue, you know, into the far distant future. As a matter of fact, the situation did change sometime afterwards, but that was the way I saw it at that time. And they finally gave me their permission, you know, so So off I went and joined the Royal Marines.
Which year did you actually join?
I joined in August 1946.
How did you find the initial training?
I enjoyed it. I'd always been fairly active as a boy, and I used to sometimes just take off into the hills with my sledge and my into the snow and so on. I was always setting myself physical tasks, and I remember once I set off to walk to Newcastle with Ordnance Survey maps off the main roads, and I sort of stuck to the hills and the trees, and I got to Newcastle about 3 days later. My kilt and my leather jacket, you know. Very often I had to use the road, and cars would stop, and people would offer me a lift, and I'd refuse, you know. So I'd always had this attitude of setting myself up against nature, if you like, and setting myself physical tasks to do. So with that kind of background, I quite enjoyed it. The initial training was tough. I mean, at that time we went to Deal. I think we were there about Deal and Kent. I think we were there about 6 months. Sort of that was just basic training, and it was pretty hard, but I knuckled down to it, and I didn't find it particularly difficult. As I say, matter of fact, I quite enjoyed it.
But what about the way in which the NCOs treat you during initial training? How did you cope with
that? Well, that of course was a bit difficult to take at first, because what in retrospect I suppose I could say that what they're trying to do is knock any strong feelings of individualism out of you, whereby you become part of a group, which is of course necessary for discipline. I could understand that. Perhaps I didn't have the same intellectual understanding in those days as I obviously do now. But it was something that everyone who joined the services did to one degree or another. Obviously, and depending on which regiment you were in, things might be a bit tougher. Probably the paras were a bit tougher. It was a bit tougher. The guards, probably. Certainly the Royal Marines. You know, and we, as I say, we had a much... I suppose we had a somewhat extended training, basic training, as sometimes in the army, the basic training is only 6 weeks to you know, a couple of months. We had about 6 months of that. It was basically square bashing. And
what methods did they use to knock the individualism out of you?
Well, the idea for them, I suppose, was to, at the end of the day, come up with a product, which when they said jump, you jumped. The only question was how high. I mean, this is the essence of all military training, and in those early days, in the basic training at Deal, you weren't encouraged to think too much about what you were doing or what you were asked to do. I suppose, in some ways, you came out of it being a bit of a robot. Later on, in later training, this changed in the Marines, at least, and I imagine it. Probably units like the Paras and the SAS, it has to change there too. But that's how I came out of there, and I must say I was pretty fit, and I quite fell in with service life, but where I could go on being an individual, I tended to go on, because I was always a bit of an individualist anyway. I tended to read perhaps more than my colleagues and so on at that time.
What type of things would you read in those days?
I read quite a lot of novels. I've always been interested in history. I read quite a lot of history. I was even into yoga and astronomy and things like that. I was quite interested in. And from there, from Deal, we then proceeded to Lympston, which is now the central command. Well, it is the commando training school now, but at that time it was just what we call our infantry training school. It was just a series of Nissen huts and concrete paths laid down in the mud. It was a wartime camp. It was a bit rough and ready. But one aspect of the infantry training I enjoyed there, as opposed to deal where I did my recruit training, was that there was much less what we call bull. You weren't polishing and cleaning all the time as you were at deal. It was a bit more. Well, of course, you were out in the countryside. You were in the mud. You were doing assault courses. You were doing. Now that I enjoyed very, very much. That training at the infantry training center, again, it was approximately about 6 months thereabouts. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed the physical challenge. And as I say, although there was discipline and everything there, it was a little bit easier in the sense that if you happened to commit some misdemeanor or something, you weren't necessarily put on a charge like you were at Deal. I was never ever put on a charge. I never ever, well, shall I say, I never got caught committing any misdemeanor. But at Limpson, the idea there was if you were caught doing anything like that, then you did 20 press-ups or 50 press-ups or 100 press-ups. That was the punishment that was meted out. It wasn't anything else. I quite enjoyed it.
What kind of wangles did the Marines get into or conduct?
You mean where they committed an offence?
Yes.
Or something? Well, there was all sorts of things. You might be laid on parade. You might have buttons undone. You might be missing a piece of equipment. Or you might fail to complete some particular order you were given.
But
like anything at all.
Were there any methods of trying to beat the system?
Oh, yes, of course.
What can you describe any?
Well, I think anywhere in the services, you always have this sort of thing. And as a matter of fact, at that time, of course, it did occur. But later on, as you with longer service, you became much more skilled in this, what we call skiving.
Yes. Can you give any instances of how you would skive?
Certainly. For instance, I remember when I came back from... I was in the Mediterranean Fleet for almost a couple of years. I was called back on a training course. And as you probably know, the Royal Marines at that time were divided into three divisions. You were Chatham Division, you were Portsmouth Division, or you were Plymouth Division. I was Chatham Division. I remember coming back from the Mediterranean. We came back by a naval destroyer and went to Chatham. And, of course, you're just in the barracks. Well, when I came home, I went on leave, and then I came back. Then I had a period of a couple of weeks where I was awaiting transfer. I was eventually transferred to the signal school at Eastonley Barracks in Portsmouth. But whilst I was there for this two-week period, the idea is, you see, that you have no official duties to perform. You simply fall in the morning at 8 o'clock on parade, and you're then given various tasks to do by whoever's in command. It might be sweeping up the parade ground, it might be a sort of kitchen detail where you're peeling potatoes and things. There wasn't a very large group of us, I suppose maybe 20, 30 people in the same situation as me awaiting posting. The idea there, of course, was not to do, to skive out of this sort of work. And people had various ways of doing it. What I did is, a couple of days after I got to Chatham, I went out one day and I bought a folder, just a manila folder, and took it back and I put some papers inside it. It was like a document or a wallet for keeping documents in. And in the morning after parade, I used to dress up rather smartly, and I just used to march around the barracks asking for some fictitious major. I'd go in and excuse me, sir, it's Major so-and-so here, you see him. Oh, no, no, don't, never heard of him. Oh, thank you very much. I used to do that for an hour or so, and then I used to go back to my room, because I was clear. And then in the afternoon, I just used to, we used to get in our civvies with civilian clothes, and just get out the gate. We just sneak out the barracks. You see, there was no way they could really check up on you. But I remember towards the end of my period there, it was quite interesting, because everyone thought this was great. This was a really good skive, you see. Forgetting that while you were skiving out of doing the manual labor, if you like, that they were being obliged to do it. But I suppose it's the same throughout all the services that, you know, if you manage to skive and get out of doing, say, arduous or physical labor, as long as you're not hurting anyone, you know, in that sense, you become a bit of a hero in a way.
But presumably you could only do that type of thing if the place was big enough to allow a certain anonymity.
Certainly, well, you heard that was part of the equation, yes. You know, you just did what you could within any given circumstances.
Now,
in the Marines, there were people who were quite expert at this, very, very expert.
Did you have a special name for them?
Not really. It was just generally known as skiving off or skiving. But it wasn't seen as a bad thing. There were areas where, you know, if people skived out of doing something which the majority might feel it was their duty to do, they came in for a certain amount of stick, you know, they were criticized for it. But on the whole, it was the thing to do.
What type of things was it not done to skive out of?
Oh, difficult for me to put my finger on anything specific.
Things that would harm other people.
Well, I suppose basically, yeah. But I honestly can't think of any specific example.
But when you say give them stick, you mean the comments would be passed?
Yeah, critical comments.
Would people get sent to Coventry or something?
Well, for instance, if you say you had a morning on the assault course. And somebody skived out of that by pretending to be sick or something, you know, then that was looked upon as something that you shouldn't do. You know, if you're fit and so on, then you do it because you join in the lads. Particularly if say a squad or say the reputation of the squad depended on everyone doing it. You understand? If someone let the squad down, then he was in for it. And he was sometimes handled, you know, physically by the rest of the squad members. So you very quickly came to understand that there were large areas where one could skive, you know, and get away or get out of doing something. But there were certain other areas that you knew. It was a kind of unwritten law. You just understood almost instinctively that, well, that sort of thing you don't do. As a Marine, you don't do, okay? But there was this large sort of amorphous area where you knew that you weren't going to be criticized by other Marines, but you're even going to be praised for having got away with doing something.
Do you remember any specific instances of people who were handled physically for overstepping the bounds?
I remember a case when we were at Deal. Now, another thing, that's an example. There was another thing there where at Deal, at the recruit centre, as I say, I enjoyed it, but, you know, there were people who sometimes found it a bit difficult. For instance, you had to be immaculately clean all the time, your equipment, even your wash and shave and all that business. You know, there were certain standards. I remember there was one lad in the squad, and he tended to be a bit what we used to call scruffy. And he was a chap that wasn't particularly keen on taking a shower or a bath when, you know, he should have been doing. And eventually the other lads in his room got so annoyed with him that they took him down the showers and they actually stripped him off and they scrubbed him with brooms and soap. And he came out of that feeling not particularly nice.
But did they object to it because he smelt, or was it just that...
He probably did. But I think the more important thing was that he was letting his squad or his group down, you know, that you had to keep up to a certain standard in cleanliness or in smartness. You had to keep up, you had to maintain certain standards. And once any individual fell below that, then he was corrected by the people around him. It was a kind of group discipline, if you like.
Do you think that was inculcated by the initial training, or do you think they would have done it without the initial training?
Perhaps a little bit of both, but I should think it was probably inculcated by the training and by this constant emphasis on being the tops. You see, there was in the recruit training centre, there was a very large element of competition, which was fostered between different squads, between different groups within a squad. Again, part of military discipline, I suppose, but it was fostered, yes.
How exactly would it be fostered? By exhortation or what?
Probably by exhortation, or probably by comment or suggestion. If the sergeant comes and says, well, so-and-so, he's slipping back and he's really letting the squad down or the group down, then if it was noticeable to him, it was probably noticeable to the other members of the squad. So the inference there being that, well, I don't want to do anything about it as far as the sergeant is concerned, but maybe you lads would like to take a hand in it. So, but this is fairly general in the services.
So there was a strong group feeling. Mm. But to what extent was this group feeling anti the Navy establishment, or to what extent was it pro the establishment?
Again, very difficult to say.
I mean, obviously the Navy establishment would have wanted the group feeling to an extent, mm. but not if it meant that it could turn against what they wanted.
I don't think it ever turned against what they wanted. Let's not forget that this tradition of discipline, if you like, goes back a very, very long way in the British services, and particularly in regiments like the Marines, who always feel, I mean, anyone in any of these regiments, you of course feel that you're better than anyone else, obviously, what they call in the Marines esprit de corps. It's a good thing. I suppose for the individual it can be a bad thing if you don't fall in with it. But most people in the Marines, you went along with that, and you... Because a large part of your training also was the history of the Marines, and it was always the Royal Marines, you see, and the emphasis was put on the glorious deeds of the Marines, and you were taught core history and various things like this. So the individual did feel this. At the same time, there was always a feeling of them and us. And them included, of course, all your officers and NCOs and so on in the recruit training center. And we, as the recruits, were on the sticky end of the wicket. You know, you took everything.
But what would have tipped the balance to make that group feeling anti-establishment, presumably unfair treatment in some way?
There was never any real anti-establishment feeling in the recruit centre. I don't know, it was...
Did you feel that you were treated fairly by the NCOs and officers?
On the whole, you were treated fairly, as long as you didn't step out of line. It could be a bit... It was a bit hard, it was physically tough. Also mentally. You know, various pressures were put on you to do this and do that. And as I say, the reason behind it is at the end of the day to produce a disciplined person by their standards of discipline. They've been doing this for, I don't know, probably hundreds of years, and it was worked out to a rather fine art. You know, there are very few individuals who could oppose that and get away with it. But you accepted it as a way of life. It was part of the whole setup of existence, if you like. You accepted it.
Say you got somebody who was a malcontent in the unit, who was grumbling in the barracks to his comrades. Would the other ones tell him to shut up or say that you didn't have to join?
Yes. If his grumblings were not universally felt by other people, if it was only an individual thing on his part, yes, oh, very much so. But there weren't many of those people. There weren't many at all.
What comments would people pass to him, typically?
Tell him to get lost, or tell him to shut up, or take him outside and fill him in.
Did that actually happen?
Well, it happened on a few occasions, but not very often. Not very often. Because most of the people there... You see, we had... I suppose, unlike national servicemen who were called up, we had gone in voluntarily. Okay, we were all... You see, at that time, there was still national service at that time, when I was a recruit at Deal. So you had two squads. You had what were called the CS squads, which were continuous service, people who were in for 12 years. And you had your HO squads, which were hostilities only, who were just in, you know, for their conscription period, 2 years, I think it was. Again, there was a great element of competition between these two groups. Because we lads who had volunteered and were in continuous service groups, we felt that we were a few notches above these other people who had just been forced into the Marines, if you like. But we had actually volunteered to do it, so therefore we felt a bit better. So if there were any malcontents and so on, they were more likely to appear in the hostilities-only squads rather than the CS squad.
Do you remember anybody getting filled in for grumbling?
I can't remember any specific example, but I should say it happened. Yes, it happened. But at the same time, there wasn't an awful lot of grumbling done because you didn't have very much time to think or to grumble. You were kept on the go pretty much all the time from when you got up, you know, at 6 in the morning. It was then a rush to get your equipment and everything ready and then have your breakfast and then get on parade by 8 o'clock. And in the course of the day, you didn't really have a lot of time to think about or to grumble about anything at all.
I wonder if the prospect of promotion and getting on in the service played a big role in keeping people contented. Were you conscious of your promotion prospects?
At that time, no, I don't think anyone was... you see, there's not much promotion in the Marines if you're in for 12 years. I mean, again, unlike, say, specialized units of the Army. I mean, for instance, some of my colleagues at the radio college, at the wireless college, they had gone into the signals. Okay, one went into the RAF. And within about 6 months, the chappie that went in the Royal Signals was a sergeant because of his past training and everything else. But promotion could be very quick in specialized units. In the Marines, you didn't become a corporal until you had served at least 4 years. It just was unknown. The normal course of events was after you'd been in the Marines and various, you know, you might serve on board ship, you might do various things. Once you're in about, say, 3 or 4 years,